bloated face, the brown purple of bruised fruit, and the angel staring straight at Karu like he could ignite her with his eyes. Issa's voice, hushed and secretive.
What can it mean that they are in the human world?
Yasri.
They must have found a way back in. It took them long enough, for all their high opinion of themselves.
This was not part of the dream. Karu had come back into consciousness like swimming to a distant shore, effortfully, and she lay silent, listening. She was on her childhood cot in the back of the shop. She knew that without opening her eyes. Her wounds stung, and the smell of healing salve was pungent in the air. The two chimeras stood at the end of the aisle of bookcases, whispering.
But why attack Karu?
Issa hissed. Yasri.
You don't think? They couldn't know about her.
Issa.
Of course not. Don't be ridiculous.
No, of course not.
Yasri sighed.
Oh, I wish Brimstone would come back. Do you think we should go and get him?
You know he can't be interrupted, but it shouldn't be long now.
No.
After a fraught pause, Issa ventured.
He'll be very angry.
Yes,
agreed Yasri, a tremor of fear in her voice.
Oh, yes.
Karu felt the two chimera looking at her and tried her best to appear unconscious. It wasn't hard. She felt sluggish, and pain blossomed across her chest, arm, and collarbone. Slash wounds to keep her bullet scars company. She was thirsty, and knew she had only to let out a murmur for Yasri to scurry toward her with water and a soothing hand. But she kept silent. There was too much to think about. Yasri had said they couldn't know about her. Know what? It was maddening, this secrecy. She wanted to sit up and scream, "Who am I?" But she didn't. She feigned sleep, because there was something else nudging at her thoughts. Brimstone wasn't here. He was always here. She had never before been granted admittance to the shop in his absence, and only the extraordinary circumstance of her nearly dying accounted for this breach. This opportunity. Karu waited until she heard Yasri and Issa moving away, peering through her lashes to be certain they had gone. She knew that as soon as she shifted her weight to stand, the springs of the cot would creak and give her away. So she reached for the strand of scuppies around her wrist. Yet another use for nearly useless wishes, to silence creaking bedsprings. She stood and steadied herself, head spinning, wounds burning, without making a sound. Yasri and Issa had taken her boots off, along with her coat and sweater, so she was wearing only bandages and a blood-streaked camisole and jeans. She went barefoot around a pair of cabinets and under hanging strings of camel and giraffe teeth, then paused, listened, and peered out into the shop. Brimstone's desk was dark, and so was Tweeka's. No lanterns lit for the hummingbird moths to flutter to. Issa and Yasri were in the kitchen, out of sight, and the whole shop was cast in gloom, which made the other door stand out all the more, a crack of light giving away its edge. For the first time in Karu's life, it was ajar. Heart pounding, she approached it. She paused for a beat with her hand on the knob, then eased the door open a fraction and peered through it. Chapter 16. Fallen. Akiva found Ezeel cowering behind a garbage pile in the Gemma Alphana, his creature still clinging to his back. A half-circle of frightened humans crowded in on them, menacing, but when Akiva dropped from the sky in an explosion of sparks, they fled in all directions, squealing like slapped pigs. The creature reached out to Akiva.
My brother,
it crooned.
I knew you'd come back for me.
Akiva's jaw clenched. He forced himself to look at the thing. Bloated as its face was, its features held an echo of long-ago beauty. Almond eyes, a fine, high-bridged nose, and sensuous lips that were perverse on such a wretched face. But the key to its true nature was at its back. From its shoulder blades protruded the splintered remnants of wing joints. Incredibly, this thing was a seraph. It could only be one of the fallen. Akiva knew the story as legend and had never wondered whether it was true. Not until this moment, faced with the proof of it, that there were seraphim exiled in another age for treason and collaborating with the enemy, cast into the human world forever. Well, here was one of them. And indeed, he had fallen far from what he once had been. Time had curved his spine, and his flesh, pulled taut, seemed to snag on every ridge of vertebrae. His legs dangled uselessly behind him. That was not the work of time, but of violence. They had been pulverized with cruel purpose, that he should never walk again. As if it were not punishment enough that his wings were torn away. Not even cut, but torn. His legs were destroyed too, leaving him a crawling thing on the surface of an alien world. 1,000 years he had lived like this, and he was beside himself with joy to see Akiva. Ezeal was not so happy. He cowered against the stinking mound of refuse, more afraid of Akiva than he had been of the mob. While Razgut gibbered,
"My brother! My brother!"
In an ecstatic chant, the old man shook with a palsy and tried to back away, but there was nowhere for him to go. Akiva loomed over him, the brilliance of his unglamored wings lighting the scene like daylight. Razgut reached longingly toward Akiva.
"My sentence is up, and you've come to bring me back. That's it, isn't it, my brother? You're going to take me home and make me whole again, so I can walk, so I can fly."
"This has nothing to do with you," said Akiva.
"What? What do you want?"
Ezeal choked out in the language of the seraphim, which he had learned from Razgut.
"The girl," Akiva said. "I want you to tell me about the girl."
Chapter 17. World Apart. On the far side of the other door, Karu discovered a passage of dull black stone. Peering out, she could see that the corridor went on for some 10 feet before turning out of sight. Just before it did, there was a window. A narrow, barred niche at the wrong angle for her to see through from where she stood. White light washed in, painting rectangles across the floor. Moonlight, Karu thought, and she wondered what landscape she would see if she crept over and looked out. Where was this place? Like the shop's front door, did this rear one open onto myriad cities? Or was this something else altogether? Some depth of brimstones elsewhere that she couldn't begin to fathom. A few steps and she might know that, if nothing else. But did she dare? She listened hard. There were sounds, but they seemed far away, echoing calls in the night. The passage itself was silent. So she did it. She prowled out. Quick, silent steps, high on the balls of her feet, and she was over to the window, peering through its heavy iron bars, seeing what was there. Her facial muscles, tense with anxiety, abruptly slackened with the onset of total awe, and her jaw actually dropped. It was a second before she realized it and snapped it closed, wincing when the sharp report of her teeth broke the silence. She leaned forward, taking in the scene before and below her. Wherever this was,
She was sure of one thing. It was not her world.
In the sky were two moons. That was the first thing. Two moons.
Neither was full. One was a radiant half-disk high overhead, the other a pale crescent just rising to clear a crust of mountain. As for the landscape they illuminated, she saw she was in a vast fortress. Huge, bermed defensive walls met at hexagonal bastions. A generous town was laid out in the center of it all, and crenellated towers, in one of which, Karu gauged by her high vantage point, she must be, reared above it all, with the silhouettes of guards pacing at their peaks. But for the moons, it might have been a fortified town of old Europe. It was the bars that made it something else. Extraordinarily, the city was banded over by iron bars. She'd never seen anything like it. They arched over the whole of the place from one expanse of rammed earth walls to the next, beetle black and ugly, enclosing even the towers. A quick study gave away no gaps. The bars were spaced so closely that no body could possibly squeeze between them. The streets and plazas of the town were entirely screened from above, as if they existed within a cage, and moonlight cast rick-rack shadows over everything. What was it about? Were the bars meant to keep something in or out? And then Karu saw a winged figure sweeping down out of the sky, and she flinched, thinking she had her answer. An angel, a seraph. That was her first thought, her heart starting to hammer and her wounds to throb. But it wasn't. It passed overhead and out of sight, and she clearly saw that its form was animal, some sort of winged deer. A chimera? She had always supposed there must be more, though she had only ever seen her four, who would never say if there were others. It hit her now that this whole city must be inhabited by chimera, and that beyond its walls lay an entire world, a world with two moons, also inhabited by chimera, and she had to grip the bars to hold herself upright as the universe seemed to tremble and grow larger around her. There was another world. Another world. Of all the theories she'd dreamed up about the other door, she'd never imagined this. A world apart, complete with its own mountains, continents, moons. She was already lightheaded with blood loss, and the revelation made her reel, so she had to clutch at the window bars. It was then that she heard voices, near, and also familiar. She had listened to their murmurs all her life as their incongruous heads bent together in discussions of teeth. It was Brimstone and Twiga, and they were coming around the corner.
"Undine has brought Thiago,"
Twiga was saying.
"The fool,"
Brimstone breathed.
"Does he think the armies can afford the loss of him at a time like this? How many times must I tell him a general need not fight at the front?"
"It is because of you that he knows no fear," said Twiga,
to which Brimstone only snorted, and that snort sounded dangerously close. Karu almost panicked. Her eyes darted back to the door she had come from. She didn't think she could reach it. Instead, she pressed herself into the window niche and held stone still. They passed her, near enough to touch. Karu feared that they would go into the shop and close the door behind them, trapping her in this strange place. She was ready to cry after them to prevent it, but they bypassed the door. Her panic subsided. In its wake, something else flared. Anger. Anger at the years of secrets, as if she weren't worthy of trust or even the barest details of her own existence. Her anger made her bold, and she determined to find out more, as much as she could while she was here. This chance, she suspected, would never come again, so when Brimstone and Twiga turned into a stairwell, she followed. They were tower stairs, a tight corkscrew down. The spiraling descent made Karu dizzy. Down, around, down, around, hypnotic, until it seemed as if she were caught in a purgatory of stairs and would go down like this forever. There were small slot windows for a while, and then they disappeared. The air grew cool and still, and Karu had the impression of being below ground. She heard Brimstone and Twiga in snatches, and could make no sense of their conversation.
"We will need more incense soon."
Twiga.
"We will need more of everything. There has not been an onslaught like this in decades."
Brimstone.
"Do you think they have their eye on the city?"
"When have they not?"
"How long?"
Twiga asked with a quaver.
"How long can we hold them off?"
Brimstone.
"I don't know."
And just when Karu thought she couldn't bear any more turning, they reached the bottom. It was here that things got interesting. Really interesting. The stairs spilled out into a vast echoing hall. Karu had to hold herself back to make sure Brimstone and Twiga had gone on. But when she heard their voices moving away, rendered small by the immensity of the space that swallowed them, she crept out after them. It seemed she was in a cathedral, if, that is, the earth itself were to dream a cathedral into being over thousands of years of water weeping through stone. It was a massive natural cavern that soared overhead to a near-perfect Gothic arch. Stalagmites as old as the world were carved into pillars in the shapes of beasts, and candelabras hung so high they were like clusters of stars. A scent was heavy in the air, herbs and sulfur, and smoke wreathed among the pillars, teased into wisps by breezes emanating from unseen openings in the cavern walls. And below it all, where Brimstone and Twiga walked down the cathedral's long nave, there weren't pews for worship, but tables. Stone tables huge as menhirs, so huge they must have required elephants to haul them there. Indeed, they were large enough to accommodate an elephant reclining, though only one of them actually did. An elephant laid out on a table. Or, no, it was not an elephant. With clawed feet and a head that was some nightmare of a massive tusked grizzly bear, it was Elsthing, Chimera, and it was dead. On each of the tables lay a dead Chimera, and there were dozens of them. Dozens. Karu's gaze fluttered, erratic, from table to table. No two of the dead were alike. Most had some human quality to them, head or torso, but not all. There, an ape with the mane of a lion, an iguana thing so huge it could only be called a dragon, a jaguar's head on the nude body of a woman. Brimstone and Twiga moved among them, touching them, examining. They paused the longest over a man. He was naked, too. He was what Karu and Zuzana would have called, with the smug smile of connoisseurs, a physical specimen. Heavy shoulders tapering to neat hips, abdomen corrugated, all the muscles Karu could identify from life-drawing study ruggedly pronounced. On his powerful chest was a down of pure white hair, and the hair of his head was white too, long and silken on the stone table. A fug of incense hung thick around him. It was coming from a kind of ornate silver lantern, suspended from a hook above his head, exhaling a steady fume. A thurnable, Karu thought, like those twirled about in Catholic Mass. Brimstone laid a hand to the dead man's chest, let it linger there a moment in a gesture Karu couldn't decipher. Fondness? Sadness? When he and Twiga moved on and vanished into the rearing wall of shadow at the far end of the nave, she crept out of hiding and went to the table. Up close, she saw that the man's white hair was an incongruity. He was young, his face unlined. He was very handsome, though blank and waxen in death, and seeming not quite real. He was also not quite human, though nearer to it than most of the Chimera here. The flesh and musculature of his legs transitioned at mid-thigh to become the white-furred haunches of a wolf. With long, backward-bending canine feet and black claws, and his hands, she saw, were hybrid, broad and furred across the backs like paws, with human fingers tapering to claws. They were lying palm up, as if they had been arranged that way, and that was how Karu saw what was etched on his skin. In the center of each palm was a tattooed eye, identical to her own. She took a startled step back. This was something. Something critical. Something key. But what did it mean? She turned to the next table, the lion-maned creature. Its hands were simian, the flesh black, but she could still make out the hamsas on them. She went to the next table, and the next, even the elephant creature. The soles of its mammoth forefeet were marked. Each of these dead creatures wore the hamsas, just like she did. Her thoughts hammered in her head the way her heart thumped in her chest. What was going on? Here were dozens of Chimera, and they were dead and naked, without, she noted, any visible wounds, and laid out cold on slabs in some kind of underground cathedral. Her own hamsas connected her to them in some way, but she couldn't imagine how. She circled back around to the first table, the white-haired man, and leaned against it. She was conscious of the scented smoke from the thurible and had a moment of anxiety when she realized her hair would be infused with the smell and give her away to Yasri and Issa when she snuck back into the shop. The shop. The thought of climbing back up that interminable corkscrew made her want to sink down into fetal position. Her wounds throbbed. They were seeping through the bandages, and Yasri's balm was wearing off. She hurt. But this place, these dead. With her muddled head, Karu felt unequal to the mystery. The white-haired man's hand lay right before her, its hamsa taunting her. She laid her own beside it to compare the marks. But his lay in the shadow of his body. So she reached out to lift it into the light. The marks were identical. She saw that as her mind worked at something else, a too slow warning from her sluggish senses. His hand. His dead hand. It was warm. It was not dead. He was not dead. A whip-crack movement and he came upright, spinning on his knees. His hand, which had lain inert in hers, caught her throat and lifted her off her feet, slamming her down onto the stone table, her head against stone, her vision blurred. When it cleared again, he was above her, eyes ice pale, lips drawn back over fangs. She couldn't breathe. His hand still clutched her throat. She clawed at it, struggled to throw him off, managed to get to her knees between them and kick out. His grip loosened, and she gasped a breath, tried to scream, but he was over her again, heavy and naked and bestial. And she fought him with everything in her, fought him with a wildness that plunged them over the edge of the table to the floor. It was chaos and thrashing, and bare limbs so strong Karu couldn't break free. He was on her, straddling her legs, staring. And some kind of crazed madness seemed to clear from his eyes. His lips eased from their snarl, and he looked human again. Almost. And beautiful. But still terrifying and confused. He gripped her by the wrists, forced open her hands to see her hamsas, then looked sharply at her face. His gaze roved over all of her so that she felt as if she were the naked one, and then he gave a thick growl that sent shudders through her. "Who are you?" She couldn't answer. Her heart was pounding. Her wounds were on fire. And, as ever, she had no answer. Who are you? He dragged her upright by her wrists and flung her back onto the stone table and was over her again. His movements were fluid, an animal, his teeth sharp enough to rip out her throat. And all at once Karu saw how her trespass through the other door was going to end. In a pool of blood, she found her breath and screamed. Chapter 18. Battle Not with Monsters.
Girl?
Ezeel squinted up at Akiva.
You mean Karu?
Karu. Akiva knew that word. It meant hope in the language of the enemy. So not only did she bear the Hamses, she had a Chimera name. Who is she? He demanded. Clearly terrified, the old man pulled himself up a little straighter.
Why do you want to know, Angel?
I'm asking the questions, said Akiva, and I suggest you answer them. He was impatient to get on and meet the others, but loath to leave with this mystery hanging over him. If he didn't find out who the girl was now, he would never know. Eager to be helpful, Razgut supplied.
She tastes like nectar and salt. Nectar and salt. And apples. Pollen and stars. And hinges. She tastes like fairy tales. Swan maiden at midnight. Cream on the tip of a fox's tongue. She tastes like hope.
Akiva was stone-faced, unreasonably disturbed by the thought of this abomination tasting the girl. He waited until Razgut gibbered into silence before he said, his voice low in his throat, I didn't ask what she tastes like. I asked who she is. Ezeel shrugged, fluttering his hands in an effort at nonchalance.
She's just a girl. She draws pictures. She's nice to me. What more can I tell you?
His voice was glib, and Akiva saw that he thought he could protect her. It was noble and laughable. Having no time to waste playing games, he decided on a more drastic approach. He seized Ezeel by his shirt front and Razgut by one of his jagged bone spurs and leapt airborne with the pair of them, hauling their combined weight as if it were nothing. It was only a matter of wingbeats before all of Marrakesh glimmered below them. Ezeel was screaming, his eyes squeezed shut. But Razgut was silent, his face displaying such unutterable longing it shot pity into Akiva's heart like a splinter. More painful, indeed, than the shard of wood Karu had stabbed him with. It surprised him. Over the years he had learned to deaden himself, and he had lived so long with the deadness that he believed pity and mercy were extinguished in him. But tonight he had experienced dull stabs of both. Slowly spiraling downward like a bird of prey, he brought the two to rest on the domed peak of the city's tallest minaret. They scrabbled to hold on and failed, sliding down its slick surface, paddling frenziedly for handholds and footholds, before coming to rest against a low, decorative parapet that was all that kept them from plummeting over the edge, several hundred feet to the rooftops of the mosque below. Ezeel's face was gray, his breathing thin. When Razgut shifted himself on the old man's back, they teetered perilously close to the edge. Ezeel let out a scream of panicked commands to stay low, not shift, hang on to something. Akiva stood over them. Behind him, the serrated ridge of the Atlas Mountains shone in the moonlight. Breezes teased the flame feathers that made up his wings, setting them dancing, and his eyes were the muted glow of embers. Now, if you wish to live, tell me what I want to know. Who is the girl? Ezeel, with a horror-struck glance over the edge of the roof, answered in a rush.
She's nothing to you. She's innocent.
Innocent? She bears the Hamsas. traffics teeth for the devil sorcerer. She doesn't seem innocent to me.
You don't know. She is innocent. She just runs errands for him. That's all.
Was that all she was? Some kind of servant? It didn't explain the Hamsas. Why her?
She's the wishmonger's foster daughter. He raised her from a baby.
Akiva processed this. Where did she come from? He knelt to bring his face closer to Aziel's. It felt very important that he know.
I don't know. I don't. One day she was just there, cradled in his arm, and after that she was always there. No explanations. Do you think Brimstone told me things? If he had, maybe I would still be a man instead of a mule.
He gestured to Razgut and fell into lunatic laughter.
Be careful what you wish for, Brimstone said. But I didn't listen. And look at me now!
Tears sprang to the wrinkled corners of his eyes as he laughed and laughed. Akiva was rigid. Trouble was, he believed what the hunchback said. Why would Brimstone tell his human minions anything, especially mad fools like this? But if Aziel didn't know, what hope did Akiva have of finding out? The old man was his only lead, and he had lingered too long already.
Then tell me where to find her, he said.
She was friendly with you. Surely you know where she lives. Woe flickered in the old man's eyes.
I can't tell you that. But I can tell you other things. Secret things about your own kind. Thanks to Razgut, I know far more of Seraphim than I do of Chimera.
He was bargaining, still hoping to protect Karu. Akiva said, you think there's anything you can tell me about my kind?
Razgut has stories.
The word of the fallen. Has he even told you why he was exiled?
Oh, I know why, said Aziel. I wonder if you do.
I know my history. Aziel laughed. One cheek was pressed flat against the dome of the minaret, and his laugh came out as a wheeze. He said,
like mold on books, grow myths on history. Maybe you should ask someone who was there all those centuries ago. Maybe you should ask Razgut.
Akiva cast a cold eye over the quivering Razgut, who was whispering his unceasing chant of,
take me home, please, brother. Take me home. I have repented. I have been punished enough. Take me home.
Akiva said, I don't need to ask him anything.
Ah, no? Ah, I see. A man once said, all you need in this life is ignorance and confidence. Then success is sure. Mark Twain, you know, he had a fine mustache. Men of wisdom so often do.
Something in the old man was shifting as Akiva watched. He saw him lift up his head to peer out over the stone lip that was keeping him from sliding to his death. His madness seemed to have abated, if indeed it hadn't all been an act to begin with. He was gathering up the tatters of his courage, which, under the circumstances, was not unimpressive. He was also stalling.
Make this easy, old man, said Akiva. I didn't come here to kill humans.
Why did you come? Even the Chimera don't trespass here. This world is no place for monsters.
Monsters? Well then, I am not a monster.
No? Razgut doesn't think he is either. Do you, monster of mine?
He asked it almost fondly, and Razgut cooed,
Not a monster. A seraph. A being of smokeless fire, yes. Forged in another age, in another world.
He was looking hungrily at Akiva.
I'm like you, brother. I'm just like you.
Akiva did not enjoy the comparison. He said, I'm nothing like you, cripple, in an acid tone that made Razgut flinch. Ezeal reached up to pat the arm that was like a vice around his own neck.
There, there,
he said, his voice ringing hollow of compassion.
He can't see it. It is a condition of monsters, that they do not perceive themselves as such. The dragon, you know, hunkered in the village devouring maidens, heard the townsfolk cry monster, and looked behind him.
I know who the monsters are. Akiva's tiger eyes darkened. How well he knew. The Chimera had reduced the meaning of life to war. They came in 1,000 bestial forms, and no matter how many of them you killed, more always came. And more.
Ezeal replied,
A man once said, Better not with monsters, lest you become a monster. And if you gaze into the abyss gazes also. Into you. Nietzsche, you know. Exceptional mustache.
Just tell me, Akiva began, but Ezeal cut him off.
Have you ever asked yourself, do monsters make war? Or does war make monsters? I've seen things, Angel. There are guerrilla armies that make little boys kill their own families. Such acts rip out the soul and make space for beasts to grow inside. Armies need beasts, don't they? Pet beasts. To do their terrible work. And the worst is, it's almost impossible to retrieve a soul that has been ripped away. Almost.
He gave Akiva a keen look.
But it can be done. If ever. If ever you decide to go looking for yours.
Fury flashed through Akiva. Sparks rained from his wings to be borne by breezes over the rooftops of Marrakesh. Why would I do that? Where I come from, old man, a soul's as useless as teeth to the dead.
Spoken, I think, by one who still remembers what it was like to have one.
Akiva did remember. His memories were knives, and he was not pleased to have them turned against him. You should worry about your own soul, not mine.
My soul is clean. I've never killed anyone. But you, oh you, look at your hands.
Akiva didn't take the bait, but he did curl his fingers reflexively into fists. The bars were etched along the tops of his fingers. Each represented an enemy slain, and his hands bore a terrible tally.
How many?
Ezeal asked.
Do you even know, or have you lost count?
Gone entirely was the quivering madman Akiva had hauled up off the cobbles of the plaza. Ezeal was sitting up now, or as near as he could come to it, encumbered as he was by Razgut, who looked back and forth in distress between his human mule and the angel he hoped had come to save him. In fact, Akiva knew the precise number of kills recorded on his hands. What about you? He threw back at Ezeal. How many teeth over the years? I don't suppose you kept count.
Teeth? Ah, but I only took teeth from the dead.
And you sold them to Brimstone. You know what that makes you? A collaborator.
Collaborator? They're just teeth.
He makes necklaces. I saw him. Just teeth on strings.
You think he's making necklaces? Fool. You've had everything to do with our war, but you are too stupid to see it. You tell me that battling with monsters has made me a monster? Doing business with devils. What has that made you?
Ezeal stared at him, mouth hanging open, then stated in a rush of sudden understanding,
You know what he does with the teeth.
Bitterly, Akiva breathed. Yes, I know.
Tell me.
Shut up,
Akiva commanded as the final tether of his patience snapped.
Tell me where to find her. Your life is nothing to me. Do you understand?
He heard the brutality in his own voice and saw himself as if from without, looming over these poor, broken creatures. What would Madrigal think if she could see him now? But she couldn't, could she? And that was the point. Madrigal was dead. The old man was right. He was a monster. But if he was, it was because of the enemy, not just a lifetime at war. That hadn't managed to make Akiva what he was. It was one act that had done this, one unspeakable act that he could never forget or forgive, and for which, in vengeance, he had vowed to destroy a kingdom. He hissed, "Do you think I can't make you talk?" To which Ezeal replied with a smile,
"No, Angel, I don't think you can."
And then he pitched himself off the minaret, carrying Razgut with him, to fall 200 feet and shatter against the roof tiles below. Chapter 19. Not Who, But What. The cathedral conducted Karu's scream and splintered it into a symphony of screams that echoed and collided so the vast vaulted space was alive with her voice. And then it wasn't. The chimera silenced her with a backhand, and she skidded off the stone slab, knocking down the metal crook and thurible, which sent up a clangor. He sprang down after her, and she thought he would tear out her throat with his teeth, his face was so close to hers. But then, he was dragged back as if plucked and thrust away. And Brimstone was there. Karu had never been so happy to see him.
Brimstone,
she choked out, and then stopped. Her relief faltered. His crocodile pupils closed to black slashes, as they always did when he was angry. But if Karu thought she had seen him angry before, this was to be an education in rage. The moment froze as he mastered his shock at seeing her there, while for Karu, an eternity revolved in the space between heartbeats.
Karu,
he snarled his incredulity, lips peeling back in a terrible grimace, his breath fast, hissed through his teeth as he reached for her, claws flexed. Behind him, the white-haired wolf chimera demanded, "Who is that?" Brimstone growled,
"That is no one."
Karu thought maybe she should run. Too late. A lunge, and Brimstone caught her arm right over the blood-tinged bandage of her last angel slash, and crushed it in his grip. Light trembled behind Karu's eyelids, and she gasped. He grabbed her other arm and picked her up, raising her so that her face was just inches from his own. Her bare feet paddled for purchase and found none. Her arms were pinned, his claws piercing her skin. She couldn't move. She could only stare back into his eyes, which had never in her life seemed so alien, so animal as they did now.
"Give her to me," said the man.
Brimstone said,
"You need rest, Thiago. You should still be sleeping. I'll take care of her.
take care of her. How? Thiago demanded.
She won't trouble us again.
Peripherally, Karu saw the familiar shape of Twigo with his long, hunched neck on sloping shoulders, and she turned to him. But the look on his face was worse than Brimstone's, because it was both appalled and afraid, as if he were about to witness something that he would rather not see. Karu started to panic.
Wait,
she gasped, writhing in Brimstone's grasp.
Wait, wait!
But he was already moving, carrying her to the stairs, taking them fast, in leaps and lunges. He wasn't careful with her, and she felt what it must be like for a doll in a toddler's hands, whipped around corners and drubbed against walls, dropped and tossed like an inanimate thing. Sooner than she would have thought possible, or maybe she lost consciousness for a time, they were back at the shop door, and he hurled her through it. She didn't land on her feet but went sprawling, catching a chair with her cheek so that a firework detonated behind her eyes. Brimstone slammed the door behind him and loomed over her.
What were you thinking? He thundered. You could not have done worse, foolish child. And you!
He spun on Yasri and Issa, who had rushed out of the kitchen and were gaping, horrified. They flinched.
If we were going to keep her here, we said there would be rules. Inviolable rules. Did we not all agree?
Issa attempted an answer.
Yes, but...
But Brimstone had rounded on Karu again and grabbed her up off the floor.
Did he see your hands? He demanded.
She had never heard his voice raised to this pitch. It was like stone grating against stone. She felt it in her skull. He was gripping her arms so hard. A whiteness washed across her vision, and she feared she was going to faint.
Did he?
He repeated, louder. She knew that no was the right answer. But she couldn't lie. She gasped.
Yes, yes!
He gave a kind of howl that chilled her worse than anything had during this whole terrible night.
Do you know what you've done?
Karu did not know.
Brimstone!
Yasri squawked.
Brimstone! She's injured!
The parrot woman's arms were flapping like wings. She tried to pry the wishmonger's hands from Karu's wound, but he shook her off. He dragged Karu to the front door and wrenched it open, shoving her ahead of him into the vestibule.
Wait, cried Issa. You can't put her out like that.
But he wouldn't hear it.
Get out. Now,
he snarled at Karu.
Get away!
He wrenched open the outer door of the vestibule. Another measure of his rage. The doors were never open together. Never. It was a failsafe against intrusion. And the last thing she saw was his face contorted with fury before he shoved her hard and slammed the door. Released so suddenly, she took 3 or 4 reeling steps backward before tripping off the curb and collapsing. And there she sat, stunned, barefoot and bleeding, light-headed and gasping in a gutter stream of melting snow. She was torn between relief that he'd let her go, for a moment she'd feared far worse than this, and disbelief that he had thrown her out injured and barely dressed into the cold. Dazed and dizzy, she hardly knew what to do. Shivering was setting in. It was frigid out, and she was soaked with gutter slush now in addition to blood. She picked herself up and stood there, uncertain. Her flat was a 10-minute walk. Already her feet burned with the cold. She stared at the door, unsurprised now to see a black handprint on its surface, and thought, surely it must open. At the very least, Issa would bring her coat and shoes. Surely.
But the door didn't, and didn't, and still didn't open. A car rumbled past at the end of the block, and here and there laughter and arguments drifted out windows, but no one was near. Karu's teeth chattered. She clutched her arms around herself, for all the good it did, and stayed fixed on the door, unable to believe that Brimstone would just leave her out here. Cold, awful moments ticked by, and finally, outraged tears springing to her eyes, Karu turned away, hugging herself, and began to limp on numb feet in the direction of her flat. She got a few wide-eyed looks along the way, and some offers of help, which she ignored, and it wasn't until she reached her door, shivering convulsively, and reached for a coat pocket that wasn't there that she realized she didn't have her keys. No coat, no keys, and no shings either, with which she would have been able to wish open the door.
"Damn, damn, damn!"
Karu cursed, tears icy on her cheeks. All she had were the scuppies around her wrist. She took one between her fingers and wished, but nothing happened. Unlocking doors exceeded a scuppy's small power. She was about to buzz a neighbor awake when she sensed, behind her, a furtive movement. She was beyond thinking. A hand came down on her shoulder, and she was all nerve and impulse. She seized the hand and threw her weight forward. The figure behind her was lifted. Karu registered a second too late, the voice, concerned, saying, "Jesus, Ru, are you okay?" to catapult over her shoulder and through the plate glass of the door. The glass shattered as Kaz sailed through it and hit the ground with an explosive grunt. Karu stood still, the awareness catching up to her that he hadn't even been trying to scare her this time. And now he was lying across the threshold in a litter of glass. She thought she should feel something. Regret? But she felt nothing at all. The problem of the locked door, at least, was solved. "Are you hurt?" she asked him flat. He just blinked, stunned, and she skimmed the scene with a cursory glance. No blood. The glass had broken into rectangular chunks. He was fine. She stepped over him and picked her way to the elevator. Throwing Kaz had cost her what little strength she had left, and she doubted she could walk up the 6 flights of stairs. The elevator doors opened and she got in, turning to face Kaz, who still hadn't moved. He was staring after her.
"What are you?"
he asked. Not who, but what. She didn't answer. The elevator doors closed and she was alone with her reflection, in which she saw what Kaz had seen. She was wearing nothing but soaked jeans and a flimsy white camisole gone see-through where it clung to her skin. Her hair clumped in blue coils around her neck, like Issa's serpents, and rust-streaked bandages hung loose from her shoulders. Against the blood, her skin looked translucent, almost blue, and she was curled over, clutching herself and shaking like some kind of junkie. All of that was bad enough, but it was her face that caught her. Her cheek was swelling from when Brimstone had flung her into the chair, and her head was set in a hard-jawed downward tilt so that her eyes were hooded in shadow. She looked like someone you'd go a long way to avoid walking past, she thought. She looked not entirely human. The elevator doors pinged open and she dragged herself down the hall. She had to climb out a window to get onto her balcony and break a pane out of her balcony door to get into her apartment, and she managed it before her strength gave out or her shivering incapacitated her, and finally she was inside, stripping off her wet clothes. She dragged herself onto her bed, tugged a quilt around her, curled up in a ball, and sobbed. "Who are you?" she asked herself, remembering the angel's question, and the wolf's, but it was Kaz's that reverberated through her, an echo that wouldn't die. What are you? What? Chapter 20. True Story. Carew spent the weekend alone in her apartment, feverish, bruised, sliced, slashed, and miserable. Rising from bed on Saturday was torture. Her muscles seemed to have been wound with winches, tight enough to snap. Everything hurt. Everything. It was hard to pick out one pain from the next, and she looked like a brochure on domestic violence, her cheek achieving coconut proportions and blooming blue to rival her hair. She considered calling Zuzana for help, but abandoned the idea when she realized she didn't have her phone. It was with her coat and shoes, bag, wallet, keys, and sketchbook, back at the shop. She could have emailed, but in the time it took to boot up her laptop, she imagined how Zuzana would react to the sight of her, and she knew her friend wouldn't let things pass this time with evasions. Carew would have to tell her something. She was too tired to come up with a lie. So she ended up feeding herself Tylenol and tea and passing the weekend in a daze of chills and sweats, pain and nightmares. She woke often to imagined sounds and looked to her windows, hoping as she had never hoped to see Kishmish with a note. But he didn't come, and the weekend went by with no one checking on her. Not Kaz, whom she'd put through plate glass, and not Zuzana, whom she'd conditioned to accept her absences with wary silence. She had never felt so alone. Monday came, and she still didn't leave the apartment. Erratically, she kept up with the tea and Tylenol. Sleep was a carousel of nightmares, the same creatures coming around again and again. The angel, the thing on Ezeel's back, the wolf, Chimera, Brimstone in fury. And when she opened her eyes, the light would have changed, but nothing else did except perhaps that her misery deepened. It was dark when the buzzer rang, and rang, and rang. She pulled herself over to the console by the door and croaked, "Hello? Carew?" It was Zuzana. "Carew, what the hell? Buzz me up, truant." Carew was so glad to hear her friend's voice, so glad someone had come to check on her, that she burst into tears. When Zuzana came through the door, she found Carew sitting on the edge of her bed, tears streaming down her battered face. She came to a halt, all five almost feet atop cartoonish platform boots, and said,
Oh, God, Carew?
She was across the tiny room in a streak. Her hands were cool from the wintry air, and her voice was soft, and Carew put her head on her friend's shoulder and cried for long minutes without stopping. Things got better after that. Zuzana got her settled without asking questions, then went out for supplies. Soup, bandages, a box of butterfly closures for sealing the split flesh along Carew's collarbone, arm, and shoulder, where the angel's sword had cut her.
"These are going to be some serious scars," said Zuzana, bent over her doctoring with the same concentration she applied to building marionettes. "When did this happen? You should have gone to the hospital right away."
"I did," said Carew, thinking of Yasri's balm. "Sort of."
"And what, are these claw marks?"
Both of Carew's upper arms were livid purple, darkest where Brimstone's fingers had sunk in, and pierced with scabbed puncture marks.
Said Carew.
Zuzana regarded her in silence, then got up and heated the soup she'd brought. She sat on a chair beside the bed, and when Carew finished eating, she kicked her feet, bootless now, up on the mattress and folded her hands in her lap.
"Okay," Zuzana said. "I'm ready."
"For what?"
"For a really good story that I hope will be the truth."
"The truth." Carew attempted a subject change.
First, tell me what happened Saturday with Violin Boy.
While she rolled the idea of truth around in her mind, Zuzana snorted.